last time when you made this like analogy between discrete Gaussian variable vectors and random fields labeled by a continuous variable t, you just translated this averaging procedure from one side to the other without commenting on how it changes. I'm just wondering if this is some sort of a path integral we're using now for averaging like products of fields or endpoint functions, or is this is there a way that transition could be more rigorously mathematically defined, or is this something we just kind of say translates directly?
Oh yeah, well if you wanted to as a concrete example, if you wanted to simulate a Gaussian field in real space with some prescribed correlation function, like let's say this is given to you as like with an analytic functional form, then what you would do empirically is just divide up your time interval with some sampling and evaluate the correlation function. So with some sample length delta t, and then evaluate the correlation function at integer multiples of delta t to fill in a covariance matrix. And strictly speaking, that's making a little bit of an approximation since it's ignoring values of the correlation function that are not at those integer separations. And so if you wanted to simulate it more accurately, you could take the spacing to be narrower. You could take it narrower, for example, than the sampling that you're ultimately interested in and downsample at the end. And a similar comment applies in Fourier space. Let's say the boundary conditions are periodic, just for simplicity. Then when I simulate a Gaussian field in Fourier space, I'm evaluating at some lattice of discrete wave numbers, multiples of some fundamental wave number, which is 2 pi over the length here. And so if I'm working in this discretized setup, I'll only ever see the power spectrum, so to speak, at integer multiples of omega naught, and that's making a little bit of an approximation. If I wanted to make things more accurate, I could take the size of the time interval to infinity, and that would fill in the gap, so to speak, and make the approximation more accurate. In going from the continuous case to the discrete case, which is what we do when we put things on the computer, there's always some sort of an approximation being made, and you might have to think in the context of a particular problem of exactly what approximation you're making and how to make it more accurate if you want to.
Just the usual QFT setup of discretizing things and then defining the continuous case by setting some sense of lattice spacing to zero. Some sort of a limit.
Yeah, except QFT is much more complicated because...
Yeah, it's like quantum mechanics, just regular one-dimensional functions of time, just one-dimensional lattice, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, as long as we're talking about Gaussian random variables, then we're talking about a probability distributions, which are x of a quadratic. And so that would sort of look like, if you wanted to think of it as a path integral, e to the minus s, where s is the action of a free QFT. Things are much simpler because we don't have to worry about renormalization or anything. We're just, there aren't really subtleties as you take the last spacing to zero for Gaussian random fields.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? Okay. So I just wanted to do some example. A lot of calculations in cosmology are calculations involving random fields. So I just wanted to do a couple of examples real quick. I'm going to do a signal processing type example and then a example involving time evolution. So the simple, the signal processing example is the following. Suppose you have a time series, which is a Gaussian random field, with some power spectrum P. And if I want to smooth out the small scale fluctuations, then one example of a filter that I might apply is a boxcar filter, where I just define a new field y of t by integrating for each time t, y of t is just defined by averaging, let me call this capital T, averaging x over some interval of length t or boxcar centered at little t. And to make it an average, let me define it with a factor of 1 over big T there. So this is what's called a low-pass filter in that it is, well, it will have unit response to a long wavelength mode, one whose wavelength is much longer than t, and it will suppress or zero out modes whose wavelength is much less than t. What I'd like to do is compute the power spectrum of y in terms of the power spectrum of x. Now, something that you can anticipate in advance is that the relationship between y and x, even though it involves an integral in real space, in Fourier space, it will not mix Fourier modes. It will just multiply Fourier mode omega by some frequency-dependent factor f of omega with no contribution from Fourier modes omega prime not equal to omega. And that's just because this averaging operator is time translation invariant, so it must operate diagonally in Fourier space. The only thing we need to compute is the factor f omega that will appear here. This argument based on time translation invariance gives you this functional form, but it doesn't tell you what f of omega is. And then whatever we get there, the power spectrum of y will be related to that of x by a factor of f squared. So just to compute that, these calculations involving going back and forth between Fourier space and real space are just sort of a matter of like following your nose. Typically, there's only one thing to do at each step. And so if you just kind of mechanically chug away, then you'll get the answer. Here, I'm starting with y of t, and the definition of y, and I want to end up in Fourier space. So I'll replace x by its, convert x to Fourier space. And then I can, there's only one thing you can do in the next step, which is interchange the order of integration and do the t prime integral. Leave the 1 over t here. Then I'll do the t prime integral like this. You could see the factor little f starting to appear. And in the last step, I'll just rewrite the result in a more compact form. So from this expression where I've written y of t as an integral over omega with the factor of e to the I omega t, you can just read off that this underbraced expression must be y of omega. So this calculation shows that the Fourier modes of y and f are related to each other by this simple expression. And as expected, the relation is diagonal in Fourier space. There's no mixing of modes omega and omega prime. And the multiplier, little f of omega, goes to 1 in the limit of a long wavelength mode omega equals 0. and goes to zero in the limit of large omega. And the power spectrum of y would just be the square of this. If you do observational cosmology, you'll do a lot of sort of signal processing calculations like this, where you are processing a map linearly in some way and want to know how the power spectrum or some other interesting quantity evolves. There are some problems on the problem set that are similar to this calculation. My second example, I have two examples of calculations involving random fields, involves some physics and some time evolution. So I want to consider the following physical setup. Suppose I have a 1 plus 1 dimensional wave equation. So I have a function field in space and time evolving via this wave equation, where I want to think of the quantity cs as the sound speed, which is why I gave it an s subscript. And imagine that I start evolving the wave equation with the following initial conditions. This is going to be kind of a toy example of what happens in the CMB, where you have waves propagating in the plasma from the initial conditions at the end of inflation to the time when the CMB is formed. At time zero, I want to assume that the spatial structure of phi is given by a random Gaussian field. So let me give this a name and call it phi I. And I want to assume that that's just randomly simulated as a Gaussian random field with some power spectrum PI. I for initial. As a trivial notational point, previously I was denoting power spectra with an omega argument, but here I switched to K because I'm thinking of the spatial coordinate now as being space instead of time. The real space coordinate is being spatial. And then since this is a second order equation, I need to also specify the time derivative of phi. To fully specify the initial condition. So let's just, for simplicity, say that's equal to zero. Then suppose I evolve the wave equation with those initial conditions to some time t, big T, and take a snapshot. A spatial snapshot. That is, define the field phi f for final, by freezing the time to time capital T. Then I'd like to compute the power spectrum of that one-dimensional field. in terms of the input power spectrum PI. By the way, in this example, it's this snapshot field phi f is a Gaussian field because it's obtained from a Gaussian field by applying a time evolution operator, which is linear. And any linear operation performed on a Gaussian field gives another Gaussian field, regardless of how complicated that linear operation is. Okay. So, as usual, the way to solve this problem is to do it in Fourier space, where the evolution, where things will be more diagonal. And in this problem, I'm going to leave the time coordinate un-Fourier transformed, but I'll take the spatial Fourier transform of the coordinate x. So I'll just change variables from phi x of t to phi tilde defined like this. I'm putting a Fourier transform on x, but not t. So after that change of variable, the wave equation will look like this. I didn't Fourier transform time, so the time derivatives stay. But d by dx will become I times k. And then when I square, I get k squared with a minus sign from squaring the I. Get this? As expected from the spatial translation invariants, each Fourier mode k will evolve in time independently of the other Fourier modes k prime. In the initial conditions, say that at time zero, the Fourier mode phi of k is just a Gaussian random number with the appropriate power spectrum. And the time derivative is zero. And this is just an ordinary differential equation, a harmonic oscillator with these initial conditions, and the solution is easy to write down. I just take whatever initial amplitude I started with and multiply it by cosine CSKT. The cosine is the solution that gives me zero time derivative at t equals zero. And so in the power spectrum, so all the time evolution is doing in Fourier space is putting in this factor CSKT. And so the power spectrum of the final snapshot is related to the power spectrum of the initial snapshot by a factor of CSK capital T with a square, because the power spectrum is the expectation value of the square. That's the initial power spectrum. So the wave equation, if I started with a simple power spectrum, suppose the initial power spectrum were some sort of boring featureless power spectrum. Then what I would find is that the acoustic physics or the time evolution has imprinted these acoustic oscillations after time t. And this is a toy version of why there are acoustic oscillations in the CMB. You've seen it, I'm sure everyone has seen a power spectrum of the CMB. I'll show one later in slides anyway, but the ripples that you see in the power spectrum of the CMB arise because some acoustic physics has processed the power spectrum of the initial conditions, which is featureless and does not have the ripples. That's really useful because it gives the CMB sensitivity to different cosmological parameters combinations. The sound speed of the plasma depends on things like the baryon abundance, omega baryon. And so when you fit for these ripples, you can determine cosmological parameters that you couldn't have determined if you just knew the power spectrum of the initial conditions. Okay.
Can I have a question? I was trying to think of another way to solve this. We know that the solution is just the poles dividing in two and going in like two different directions, right, with the same velocity.
Oh yeah.
You have the initial thing, since it's time symmetric, okay. You know it divides in two, so you know it's just this with a minus dc and this with a plus dc.
Oh yeah.
And you can Fourier transform that, and you should get that.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's just if you want to split things up into like a left moving part and a right moving part, it's sort of like splitting things up into positive and negative frequencies. Mm-hmm. And you'll end up with the cosine when you match the boundary conditions that the derivative has to be zero. Okay. So now I want to. I want to make one more little comment on the power spectrum or the two-point function, which is a little pedantic, but I think it's comes up often enough that I think it's worth pointing out. So I had defined the two-point function this way with a star on one of the x's. And that's just a choice in writing things down. If I had defined the Fourier space two-point function without the star, then there's an identity that says that. So I've been assuming that my random fields are real valued in real space. And in Fourier space, if you work out what this condition is equivalent to, it says that, oops. The Fourier modes at frequency omega and frequency minus omega are complex conjugates of each other. So, plug in that identity in over here, I would just switch the sign of omega prime, and the delta function would become a delta function omega plus omega prime. So these two ways of writing the two-point function or of defining the power spectrum are equivalent to each other. In fact, if you really want to simulate Gaussian random fields on the computer, then you would do it in Fourier space. And since x of omega is a complex number, then you actually need a little 2x2 covariance matrix for each omega. So it might seem from the way that I defined the Fourier space two-point function that you don't have enough information to fill in the covariances between the real and imaginary parts. In fact, these covariances can all be calculated given these expressions. It's just not immediately obvious. But I forgot some x's. Should be the real part of x of omega. compared to x of omega prime. We're going into a little bit of detail here because when you actually go to do calculations on the computer or something, then you might have to unpack this into its real and complex parts. There's a little more going on than initially appears. So if you needed to compute this, for example, you would just unpack the real part into x and x star like this. And then by multiplying this out and applying these identities, then you would get an expression like this. And similarly for the other forms, if you did this calculation for the covariance of a real part with an imaginary part, you would get 0. And for two imaginary parts, you get this result, but with a minus sign. And that's pretty easy to interpret. It just means that if you were simulating a Gaussian random field in Fourier space, then if I write down the real degrees of freedom that I need to simulate in this order, then I just get a diagonal matrix There's no covariance between real parts and imaginary parts, and there's no covariance between omega 0 and 2 omega 0. There's just a factor of 1/2 that comes out of the calculation that you need to put in. This is a minor point, but it will come back when we write down likelihood functions and talk about data analysis next week. Okay. So far, I've just talked about Gaussian random fields in one dimension. And generalizing to n dimensions is kind of straightforward and doesn't really involve surprises. But I also want to talk about the case of Gaussian random fields on the two-sphere. I'm going to start filling in entries of a table, generalizing the various results that we've derived to the case of an n-dimensional Euclidean random field, which will be a fairly straightforward generalization of the n equals 1 case that we've been talking about. Or to the case of a random field defined on the 2-sphere, which will not be a straightforward generalization. No, and I'm generally going to assume full symmetry, which means In the n-dimensional Euclidean case, I'm assuming a random field, which is invariant under an n-parameter translation, set of translations. And the full set of rotations, which has dimension n times n minus 1 over 2 and n dimensions. And in the two-sphere, full symmetry means invariant under the full three-dimensional symmetry group. By the way, in cosmology, one-dimensional random fields are basically always time series. So when I think about a 1D random field, I'm kind of hardwired to think about something with units of time in real space. And two-dimensional random fields are basically always functions of angle. So if you have a telescope that's making an image, then the pixels in that image are you can view as a random field in two dimensions. So because our sky is a sphere, two-dimensional random fields in cosmology are pretty much always fields defined on the two-sphere. Unless your observations are confined to a small enough part of the sky, and then you can make the so-called flat sky approximation and treat your image as a two-dimensional Euclidean random field, where the math is usually significantly simpler. So one thing that I often do if I'm trying to calculate something new, and I'm eventually interested in the all-sky case, where all fields live on the two-sphere, is I'll warm up by first doing the calculation in the flat sky approximation, where the random fields are just defined on a Euclidean two-dimensional plane. Three-dimensional random fields in cosmology are basically always spatial random fields defined on some spatial slice of the universe. So a real space field in the n-dimensional case will be a function phi of an n-component vector x. And in the case of a field defined on the two-sphere, I'll use the notation phi of n, where n hat is a unit three vector. The correlation function if I were making no symmetry assumptions, then the correlation function here would just be an arbitrary function of the positions x and x prime, or a function of 2n real variables. But under this large set of symmetries, the correlation function, first by translation invariance, can only depend on the separation between the two points. Now, if translation symmetry is all I was assuming, then the two-point correlation function could depend on this vector separation, on all n components of the vector separation. But the rotation symmetry means that it has to be a function only of the length of that vector. So the correlation function is just a function of one real number, the separation r between two points in space, as in the one-dimensional case. And on the two-sphere, if I have a random field on the two-sphere, then the correlation function between its value in direction n and in direction n prime is a function of the angular separation between the point, those two directions where to write down a definition for that, I could write it this way. If n and n prime are unit three vectors, and this dot is the three vector dot product. Fourier space representation. For a random field phi in an n-dimensional Euclidean space, I can write its Fourier transform like this. And the function phi tilde of k prime is the Fourier space representation of the field, and it's also a function of n real variables, the n components of the wave number k. On the two-sphere, the analog of this Fourier representation is the representation of phi as a linear combination of spherical harmonics. That's a discrete sum instead of a continuous integral. So these spherical harmonics, spherical harmonics YLM are special functions which pop up all over physics, and I'm sure you've seen them. I guess they're usually denoted in coordinates theta phi instead of my notation n hat. And I'm sure you've seen them in quantum mechanics or E&M or other physics classes. So just recall that these depend on a angular momentum L, which is quantized to be a non-negative integer. And then for each L, there are 2L plus 1 allowed values of M, also integers. And the coefficients for an arbitrary function phi defined on the sphere, you can express it as a linear combination of spherical harmonics. And so there's some set of coefficients, ALM, which depend on the function phi. And that set of coefficients is the Fourier space representation of the field. So on the sphere, I can think of a function either in real space, where it's a function of this sky location n, or as a discrete set of coefficients, ALM. You know, the step from going from the two-dimensional Euclidean plane to the two-sphere is not a big conceptual leap. Conceptually, you're just replacing a plane wave of the form e to the I k dot x by a spherical harmonic YLM. But depending on what you're computing, it can be quite a lot more algebraically complex. This working with plane waves generally, there's some you don't need to know a lot of special function identities. Things are relatively simple. But working with spherical harmonics can be a real mess. Okay. The inverse Fourier transform if I have, these formulas tell me how to go from the Fourier space representation to the real space representation. And if I want to do the reverse, then I would do this in Euclidean space. A lot of the entries in the left side of the table are like not really, are so straightforward that they're not really worthy of being an entry in the table. And it's really just an excuse to show the right column and then explain what that's equivalent to. So if I, in the right column, what I'm looking for is a formula for ALM given the function phi. And ALM can be computed by just, given the real space representation phi of n, if you want to compute its harmonic space representation or compute one of these coefficients ALM, then you just integrate phi times the complex conjugate of the corresponding spherical harmonic. Now there's this pedagogical issue when I teach this that I want to derive the things that I am writing in the right-hand column, but it turns out that these entries are usually just equivalent to some special function identity. So here the special function identity that's being used is the statement that the spherical harmonics are orthonormal. If I integrate y times the complex conjugate of another y, then the result is 0 unless the L's and M's both match, and then it's 1. So given that identity, this formula is easy to prove if you start with this as the definition of the ALMs, and then multiply both sides by YLM star and integrate. Then only one term survives on the right-hand side, namely the term containing ALM. That's why you get ALM when you do the integral. But that's not really much of a derivation, because I just explained it in terms of something that I didn't derive. Right? What I really showed is that this formula for the inverse transform is equivalent to a special function identity. And I thought about going through and proving all the special function identities that I'm going to use. But I decided not to do it, because that's just a really boring lecture. No one, special function identities are things that you just end up memorizing or looking up. They're not really, I find them kind of fun to derive, because I'm a masochist for this sort of thing, but I don't think it makes sense to do in lecture. Okay. Oh yeah, one more thing. By default, my random fields will be always be real valued in real space, meaning that phi equals phi star in real space. And that always has an equivalent statement in Fourier space. As mentioned previously, in the Euclidean case, it just says that the value of phi at Fourier mode k and the value of phi at Fourier mode minus k are complex conjugates of each other. Now, that's true for a real valued field. If the field were complex valued in real space, then phi of k and phi of minus k would be independent. And the corresponding identity over here for spherical harmonics says that ALM star is related to AL minus M. And it turns out there's a factor of minus 1 to the M with the usual phase convention for defining spherical harmonics. And that's just equivalent to, that follows very straightforwardly if you know this special function identity that says that it's just the corresponding statement for the YLMs themselves, that the complex conjugate of a YLM is minus 1 to the M times Y L comma minus M. So the negative M's, in particular, this says that AL0 is real. And the positive values of M are all complex numbers. But then they're related to the negative values of M by complex conjugates. So from this, you can see that for each value of L, there are 2L plus 1 real degrees of freedom. So to specify a spherical map in harmonic space, I need to specify the following two L plus one real numbers. AL0, which is real, the real part of AL1, the imaginary part of AL1, and so on up to the real and imaginary parts of ALL. And that counting, that there are two L plus one real degrees of freedom for each value of L, is, I think, more important than the details of how it works.
Sorry. So how does this follow from reality condition?
You could let me offer two different derivations. One is if you star both sides of... Oh, I'm sorry, were you asking how to prove this from this?
No, I'm asking why does the 2L plus 1 real degrees of freedom follow?
This identity implies that AL0 is real, specialized to if I take m equals 0 on both sides. And then for the non-zero m's, all it says is that the positive m's are related to the negative m's by a complex conjugate and a sign. So that I can fill in the positive m's in an arbitrary way. I can fill in their real and imaginary parts in an arbitrary way. And then use the identity to get the negative m's. So these numbers are all independent. This set of 2L plus 1 numbers are all independent, and there are no constraints among them that follow from this identity. Once you specify these numbers, the negative m's, or the real and imaginary parts of the AL minus m's, are determined by the identity. Next up is the power spectrum. So what I mean is, in the Euclidean case, we considered the two-point function in Fourier space. And remember that for n equals 1, we argued by translation invariance that there has to be this delta function on the right-hand side. If you repeat that argument in the n-dimensional case, then you'll see that it just says that there has to be an n-dimensional delta function here on the right-hand side. Now, if I were assuming translation symmetry alone, then the translation symmetry would tell me that this delta function that setting k equal to minus 2 k prime exists on the right-hand side. But if I were just assuming translation symmetry, then it would allow the... that's all you could conclude. And the prefactor p of k could depend on both the length and the direction of k. So the power spectrum would be a function of n real variables. The rotation symmetry means that the power spectrum can only depend on the length of k, not on which direction it's pointing in, since there are no preferred directions in space. So that's why I've written, since I'm assuming full symmetry, I've written p without the vector over the k.
Sorry, then you said for n-dimensional space we have n times n minus 1 divided by 2 rotations. I know it's the selection of 2 out of n.
How did this counting work? Why are there n times n minus 1 independent rotations in n dimensions?
Yeah.
That is, I sort of wrote that down for fun. It's not really very important in the counting, but just to explain how it works. One. I'm trying to think of a good proof. So.
So a vector minimum needs two axes. Yeah.
What's that?
If you have a vector, you should have more than one dimension. So is that that's why you are going to say like if I have n axes, I need like any selection of two out of n to basically define different directions. Is that?
It's true that. The rotation group in n dimensions has dimension n times n minus 1 over 2. In other words, the space of all matrices R such that R transpose is equal to R inverse has dimension. So this space has dimension. This is a total digression, but I think it's a fun digression, so I'll go ahead and talk about it. And that's not totally obvious, but I'll offer this. I think this is the most intuitive proof. If I want to, imagine that I want to specify a rotation in n dimensions, then what I could do is think of the rotation as transforming some set of n orthogonal basis directions into some other set of orthonormal vectors. And if you think about the number of continuous parameters that you need to specify to determine that rotation, then I can send axis 1. Imagine specifying the rotation first by saying where axis basis direction 1 goes, and then basis direction 2, and so on, then basis direction 1 can go anywhere on an n minus 1 dimensional sphere. So there's n minus 1 parameters there. And then basis direction 2 can go anywhere on the n minus 1 dimensional sphere that's orthogonal to that. So it can go anywhere on an n minus 2 dimensional sphere. Basis direction 3 can go anywhere on an n minus 3 dimensional sphere, and so on until the last basis direction, I guess, is its position is forced by the previous one, so there's a 0 there. And if I add this up, I'll get n times n minus 1 over 2. That's not the only proof that's possible, but I think this is the most intuitive way to see it. Okay. So in Fourier space, for an n-dimensional Euclidean random field, the symmetry shows up. This equation is both a theorem and a definition. It says that the symmetry constrains the right-hand side to have this n-dimensional delta function in it, and that the prefactor can only depend on a single real number, the length of the wave number k. And it's also a definition. It defines the power spectrum p of k. So what's the generalization of this to the spherical case? It'll be some identity with the harmonic space two-point function on the left-hand side. That is the correlation of an ALM with an ALM star, where the values of L and M can be different. And then on the right-hand side, I want to write down some sort of constrained form which tells me how symmetry constrains the two-point function. And that form will also define what I mean by the power spectrum. And so this is the result. And this is very non-trivial to prove. It's not, this identity is not equivalent to, straightforwardly equivalent to a particular special function identity, but it's like a theorem that requires some work to prove. So it says that if I have any random field on the sphere, if it's statistics or rotation invariant, then ALM, the different ALMs for different values of L and M are uncorrelated, meaning L can only correlate with L prime and M can only correlate with M prime. And the coefficient here depends on L, can depend on L, but not M. And that is the definition of the power spectrum CL. A more uniform notation would be to denote it like PL. But it's become a standard notation in cosmology to denote, in the all-sky case, to denote the power spectrum C sub L. But it's just the all-sky generalization of the quantity P of L for an integer wave number L. On the sphere, wave numbers are always quantized to be integers. So the power spectrum, for example, is, strictly speaking, only defined at integer values of L. We'll see it plotted as a, if you see like the CMB power spectrum plotted, you'll see it plotted as a continuous curve. But strictly speaking, it's only defined at integer values, and it's just connected up as a line by the plotting script. Okay. So, I actually have like another blackboard full of table, but it's somehow it got to be 12:30, so I guess I'll have to stop there for today. There's this time dilation effect at the blackboard where I only cover like half as much as I think I'm going to be able to cover in an hour, and I never seem to learn no matter how many lectures I get. Okay, thanks everyone. And the tutorials today at 2, if you haven't had a chance to get going with the computer software stuff, I would suggest trying to do it in this tutorial. I'll be around to answer questions.